This is Yaron Brook, guest speaking on Dr. Leonard Peikoff's podcast. I'm here to apply Ayn Rand's philosophy of objectivism to your real-life questions. Your real-life questions specifically to current events, including politics, economics, and foreign policy. My answers are posted every other week on Mondays. Leonard will continue to answer questions, but now only on alternate Mondays. You can listen to full episodes on iTunes or listen to single questions or full episodes at www.peikoff.com. If you have a question to ask me, simply go to peikoff.com/questions. So this is a foreign policy question, again, following up, I think, on some of the previous questions that I've been asked, particularly about America's relationship with Israel, but this is broader. So the question is, how should we support our allies in the broad sense? And what does supporting an ally mean and so on? So the point I made, which the questioner agrees with, that you have to ask the question, allies in what? What are we allied? What is the threat in which we allied against? So let's say there's a threat. There's a threat that mysticism and collectivism and regimes that are dominated by mysticism and collectivism, they threaten the West generally, the better countries in the West, let's say, you know, United States, Western Europe, certain countries in Asia. So does it make sense for those countries to ally in some way in order to protect themselves? And yes, absolutely. So, you know, to the extent that Russia is a threat to our values, maybe not a threat, such a threat that the United States needs to be engaged militarily, but it's a serious threat to Germany because Germany, you know, doesn't quite have a border with Russia, but the border's not that far. Germany is kind of an ally. It shares our values. Should we help them, for example, by providing them with intelligence? Absolutely. Should we help them in a sense of moral support? Absolutely. Should we sell them weapons? Absolutely. Should we send troops? I don't think so. Again, I don't think American kids need to die in order to protect Germany from the Russians. So this could be applied to Israel. You know, should we sell Israel weapons? Yes. Should we trade, given that they do a lot of military developments that we learn from? Should we buy those from the Israelis? Absolutely. Should we provide them with intelligence on how to protect themselves better? Sure. You know, so all these things that are costing us nothing or very little, particularly if we're trading intelligence, because we get intelligence from them on threats to the United States, that's certainly happening. All of that absolutely is the case. When do we engage our troops? Our troops need to be engaged when the threat is to the lives and property of Americans, or where we believe that, you know, this will directly lead to a threat to the lives and property of American citizens. Now, how you apply this on a case-by-case basis is hard. It's not easy. This is why, again, I believe government is a very important function. And being president, probably the most important function of being president in a rational world, not in the world we live in today, where he controls all of our lives, but in a rational world, the issue of foreign policy is probably the biggest issue a president has to deal with. And the issue of how to deal with allies and how to deal with enemies and when to go to war and when not to go to war and how to support enemies without going to war and what treaties to sign and what alliances to form and how to define those alliances and how to find the threats. These are indeed the primary responsibilities of the president, you know, in consultation, of course, with Congress, and declaration of war has to come from Congress and all of this. These are complicated decisions and hard decisions, and you'd have to treat them on a case-by-case basis. The principle, again, is you want to help those fighting your enemies up to the point of actually threatening the lives of American citizens, i.e. your own soldiers, unless you believe that the threat is such that it would be a threat to the lives and property of Americans. Where's that line? It's hard. I mean, you know, I know objectivists who disagree with Ayn Rand, who Ayn Rand didn't believe the United States should enter World War II. I mean, once it was attacked, it had to, because the Nazis weren't a real threat to the United States. And if we hadn't helped the Russians, then the Russians and the Nazis basically would have beaten each other to death, and the whole thing would have collapsed ultimately without ever threatening the United States of America. But that's not true if you're the UK, right? In the UK, there's a small canal between you and the Nazis. They're coming for you. You can't just take this attitude. You have to be much more engaged and much more involved. So it really is contextual. Which country are we talking about? The United States? The United States can afford to be more removed, if you will, than other countries because of its distance. But, at the end of the day, the standard has to be the job of the U.S. government, the British government, the German government, whatever, is to defend their citizens and their property. And the use of force is justified only when the rights of their citizens are threatened. So this is a question about vaccinations, and the question is, what is the objectivist perspective, or what is my perspective, let's put it that way, regarding vaccinations? A significant minority of parents not choose not to vaccinate their children, yet expect them to be allowed to fully participate in society, attending public school, etc. Well, this is the problem, or one of the big problems, is that schools are public. If schools were private, if everything was private, which is what really what Ayn Rand's definition of capitalism is, right? Everything is private. Then if you choose not to vaccinate your kids, I can choose not to have them in my school. I can choose not to allow them in my store. I can choose not to allow them on my playground. I can choose not to have them interacting with the other kids in the neighborhood who are vaccinated if their property in the neighborhood is privately owned. So the remedy for not vaccinating is private action. And certainly in a school, you could imagine that the school could require all the kids to present at the start of the year a document that's saying that they were all vaccinated. And if you don't want to get your kids vaccinated, then you can't send them to that school. You know, start your own schools. So a lot of these issues go away once you take away the issue of public property and once you privatize everything. Now, if there's a disease and, you know, a few people don't get vaccinated and it's a deadly disease and they get sick and they die, and since everybody else is vaccinated, then, you know, the fact that they were irrational does not affect me. They're killing themselves, and particularly in a private economy where I don't have to fund their health care and the emergency services for them. So I don't think that in a rational society, vaccinations would be mandatory by government. They would be mandatory because of a voluntary association. That is because schools wouldn't have to accept all kids. Stores wouldn't have to accept all patrons. People could discriminate against those who are not vaccinated. So this is a question about inequality. The argument here is, I've said sometimes to the issue of inequality, who cares? And he's saying, but wait a minute, there's an important argument to be made that interference in free market have increased inequality, whether through crony capitalism, corporate welfare, straggling taxes and regulations, and so on. So shouldn't we really focus on that? And isn't that much more effective line of debate than my line of who cares? And I say you have to do both. You have to say who cares, because that's the whole issue. The argument out there is not inequality is bad because it's a result of cronyism and result of bad stuff. No, the argument is, if you read Piketty, if you read a lot of these inequality fearmongers, the argument is, no, inequality is bad in and of itself, no matter how it's arrived at. And that has to be argued against. That has to be defeated. And then one can say, look, and then there's crony capitalism. And crony capitalism might be doing stuff to inequality. And by the way, I don't know if it's increasing it, reducing it, distorting it, perverting it. Clearly distorting it, perverting. But in which direction? How is it making it worse? There is no worse or better, because I don't know what the right level of inequality is. The right level of inequality is that level produced by a free market. So yes, the level of inequality today is wrong. It could be bigger. It could be smaller. All we know is it's wrong today because it's arrived through a distortion in the marketplace, cronyism, all the stuff you list, the Federal Reserve, all this stuff. So you have to separate the two issues and say, on moral grounds, there's no problem, or economic grounds, there's no problem with inequality, one way or the other. There's no right level, there's no wrong level, other than complete equality. Obviously, that's wrong. And then from a moral economic perspective, the cronyism issue, that's wrong. It's wrong because it violates rights. It's wrong because it's bad economically. It's wrong because it hurts the ability of the individual to pursue his life and to pursue his happiness. It's wrong. So you got to separate the two issues out in the inequality debate. They're not one issue. So this is a question about currency and value. And at the end of the day, he's asking, how do you measure the value in terms of currency? And of course, this is very difficult because of the level to which our currency is being manipulated, the level to which the Federal Reserve prints money, distributes money, the effect this has both on prices, also on the relationship between our currency and other currencies, and its relationship to gold, and so on. So I don't have a clear answer. At the end of the day, the value of the currency is what it's able to purchase. It's the other way around, right? What can you buy with it? If you can buy more, then the currency's value's gone up. If you can buy less, then the value of the currency has gone down. Of course, this is hard because what you're buying changes from year to year, certainly from decade to decade, from century to century. The types of products, you can't compare a computer to a calculator to a sliding ruler, right? So these are completely different products, and it's hard to put into your economic calculation the value of innovation, the value of a far superior product. You can measure the value of the currency in terms of gold. I think long-term, this is a good way to do it. I think long-term, the value of gold, the purchasing power of gold is relatively stable. At least I think that's true. But again, you could have distorted periods. You could have periods in which people are buying gold for speculative reasons, that the marketplace is valuing gold wrongly, if you will, not based on its purchasing power, not based on its value as a currency, in a sense, as money, but for other reasons. And so in the short run, you can have distortions. In the long run, gold is probably as good of a way to measure the value of a currency as any. But it's still complicated. What is the long run? And all of these economic calculations are very, very complicated because of how distortive the mixed economy is and how sophisticated our central bankers have come in distorting the market, in distorting the value of money. So just a quick one. Why is there no agreement among objectivists on the issue of immigration? I think the answer is that the application of abstract ideas, of abstract philosophy, is not easy. And that there's disagreement here, not on what the position on immigration would be in a free society, but what the position would be on this particular issue in a mixed economy. And I think in a mixed economy, on any particular policy, there's probably disagreement among objectivists over a lot of different things, over a lot of different issues, specific issues like this. There's disagreement about how bad things are today, about the net effect, for example, immigrants have, about, you know, how close we are to complete collapse as a society, about where the immigrants would come from, about the type of people who immigrate or wouldn't immigrate. So the actual practical questions in a mixed economy and a mixed world are not that easy to sort out, to figure out. It's the same about, well, is there agreement among objectivists about how to phase out Social Security? Well, probably not. There are probably 5-6 different views out there on how to do it. Some people believe go cold turkey, eliminate it tomorrow. I don't share that belief. I think you need to ease us out of it over a generation. But should it be a generation? Should it be 10 years, maybe 5 years, maybe 17 years? I think everybody agrees on the ultimate, you know, kind of open immigration view in a free society. But how do we get there? Do we get there by going cold turkey today, opening up the borders, and that's it? Do we get there by increasing immigration today? Do we get there by shutting down immigration today but committing to freeing it up tomorrow? So there are a lot of issues of implementation and how we get from here to there along the way that I think are valid disagreements within the context of a complex world that is made very murky by the mixed economy.
If you want to know more about Ayn Rand's philosophy, I invite you to ask me a question. I can't answer them all, but I do read them all. Just write to leonard@peakoff.com. And if you haven't already done so, start by reading Ayn Rand's two most important novels, The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. And I might add that it wouldn't hurt you to read my latest book, The Dim Hypothesis.